Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week's African American Hour has three readings. The featured reading will be a look at Vice President Kamala Harris's sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, from the New Yorker magazine. I'll wrap up with a book review from the Guardian newspaper, and I'm starting with this story out of Virginia. Colonial Williamsburg restores America's oldest black schoolhouse, uncovering a legacy of education and resilience. It was written by Stacy Brown and published November 4, 2024, in the Washington Informer newspaper and its WashingtonInformer.com website. Colonial Williamsburg is nearing completion on the restoration of the Williamsburg Bray School, the oldest surviving schoolhouse for black children in America. Founded in 1760 by the Associates of Dr. Bray, a British Anglican charity, the school was established to teach enslaved and free black children to read, albeit through a curriculum that promoted religious submission to slavery. Yet, for the hundreds of students who passed through its doors, literacy opened possibilities far beyond their assigned roles. The school's dedication on November 1st marked a milestone in the project's meticulous restoration efforts, with public tours set to begin this spring. Located on the grounds of Colonial Williamsburg in partnership with William & Mary Bray School Lab, the Williamsburg Bray School stands as a testament to the oppression and resilience woven into early American history. The Smithsonian Secretary Lonnie G. Bunch III, who served as the keynote speaker, emphasized the significance of the structure by saying that it has extraordinary potential to demonstrate how a small number of people's dreams helped shape the values of many people. Dendrochronology, a method of dating wood by its growth rings, helped identify the schoolhouse in 2020, confirming that it was built in the winter of 1759 or spring of 1760. Colonial Williamsburg's team, under the direction of Architectural Preservation Director Matt Webster, has now identified the 89th original structure in Williamsburg's historic area. More than 80 former students, now identified through Colonial Williamsburg's research, attended the Bray School in the 1760s. Among them was Isaac B., who later emancipated himself. His enslaver placed ads in the Virginia Gazette warning that B can read. Aberdeen, Bristol, and Phoebe, ages 5, 7, and 3, were among other students taught by Ann Wager, the school's only teacher, who instructed over 300 black children in reading, Christianity, and obedience. Despite the pro-slavery curriculum, many students quietly resisted by sharing literacy with others in their communities. It's a story of resilience and resistance, Maureen Lee, the Bray School lab director, told the Associated Press. The Bray School's teachings may have been rooted in pro-slavery ideology, but education had a way of empowering these children. Lee and her team continue researching descendants, with several students tracing their ancestry to black households such as the Jones and Ashby families. Janice Kennedy, the descendant of former students Elisha and Mary Jones, is now Colonial Williamsburg's African American Community Engagement Manager. Reflecting on her heritage, Kennedy shared, "To know what your family has come through, that's where your power is." The Bray School was an exception in a time when most colonies prohibited educating black people. Though Virginia imposed anti-literacy laws later in the 1800s, Colonial Williamsburg has uncovered evidence suggesting Bray students went on to influence their communities. Jody Allen, director of the Lemon Project, noted that the students likely taught siblings and others what they learned, enabling literacy as an act of defiance. Since its rediscovery, the Bray School has undergone extensive preservation efforts overseen by Colonial Williamsburg. The team restored historically accurate wooden sills and brickwork, maintaining nearly 75% of the original structure. Officials said the preserved building will anchor research on the intersections of race, religion, and education, shedding light on a part of America's past often overlooked. This was an incredibly important opportunity both to understand the Bray School and to understand Williamsburg in the 18th century, Webster stated. The school, originally recommended by Benjamin Franklin as a site for black education, also illuminates the lives of early black educators in Virginia. William and Mary Professor Emeritus Terry Myers said the Bray School likely fostered Virginia's first black teachers. Colonial Williamsburg President Cliff Fleet also stressed the educational significance of the school's story. William and Mary President Catherine Rowe noted that the restored building will serve as a living testament to the resilience and strength of the black students who defied their roles by embracing literacy. The research will continue as scholars, descendants, and visitors explore the Bray School's historical role. Researchers hope to relocate the building to Colonial Williamsburg Historic Area, preserving the space where generations of black children gained the knowledge that helped shape their futures. This project honors not just the children who learned here, but their courage to transcend the limitations set before them, said Bunch, a resilience that endures in the story of our nation. That was the article, Colonial Williamsburg Restores America's Oldest Black Schoolhouse, Uncovering a Legacy of Education and Resilience. It was written by Stacy Brown and published November 4, 2024, in the Washington Informer newspaper. My next reading is about the sorority that my mother, my sister, and at least five other members of my family are a member of, Alpha Kappa Alpha. The title is Alpha Girls, Inside the Tight-Knit World of Kamala Harris's Sorority. It was written by Jasmine Hughes and published October 28, 2024, in the New Yorker magazine. The advice flying around the last night of the Democratic National Convention this past August at Chicago's United Center was not to leave your seat after 9 p.m. All day, social media and the convention hall had been abuzz with rumors that the night would end with a performance by Beyoncé, or maybe Taylor Swift, or maybe in a show of interracial solidarity the world had never seen before, they would perform together. Although the superstars never materialized, the crowd was still electric as it waited for the true headliner of the night, Vice President Kamala Harris, who would be accepting the Democratic presidential nomination. An hour before Harris appeared, the comedian D.L. Hughley took the stage and addressed what was perhaps the most enthusiastic demographic in the arena, members of Harris's sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha. "Where are those AKAs at?" he said, and nodded as the room filled with cheers. "In 3 months, ain't nobody gonna be living with y'all." If Harris wins the election, she will not only be the first female president, she'll also be the first member of AKA to reach the Oval Office. Since its inception in 1908, Alpha Kappa Alpha, a historically black sorority, has never endorsed a political party or a candidate. As a nonprofit organization, it isn't allowed to. The sorority's leadership had strongly discouraged the display of Alpha Kappa Alpha insignia at the Democratic National Convention. There would be no pearl-encrusted ivy leaf pins, no brooches spelling out the organization's founding year. And yet, floating among the convention's 50,000 attendees, like lily pads across the pond, were hundreds of black women dressed in the sorority's colors, vibrant greens and various shades of pink, hot rose pastel. The organization's official hue is salmon pink, but it doesn't specify the temperature of the fish. I spotted someone in a pink and green patterned dress descending the grand staircase of the United Center as if for a prom picture. Several women wearing fuchsia hats and dye green denim stood in line for chicken tenders. One woman toted a pink bag with green letters that spelled out, "Thank you for shopping here." 30 of the Jewels of Iridescent Splendor, as the AKAs who were initiated with Harris at Howard University were called, had traveled to Chicago from places like California, Texas, and Tennessee, taking time off from their jobs as lawyers, nurses, accountants, and teachers. They wore white in honor of the suffragettes, with nods to their group, a magenta blouse, a string of pearls. The corporate securities lawyer Jill Lewis watched her line sister's speech. On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination to be the President of the United States of America, Harris beamed to the crowd from the convention stage, and told me later that she recognized Harris's discipline, fortitude, and resilience from their time in Alpha Kappa Alpha. That strength doesn't have to be iron, Lewis said. It is an elegant strength. She pointed to the symbols of the sorority, the hardy ivy plant that can survive in many climates, the beautiful pearl that is wrought through agitation. Being able to move forward through adversity is built into the fabric of Alpha Kappa Alpha, she told me. That training has been remarkably effective. AKA members are a who's who of political, cultural, and business luminaries. Minnie Jean Brown Trickey, one of the Little Rock Nine, and Bernice King, a daughter of Martin Luther King Jr., both pledged AKA. Toni Morrison was an AKA, as is the poet Sonia Sanchez. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, before she became the first female elected president in Africa, joined AKA. It is the most represented sorority in Congress today. The first black woman to go to space. The first WNBA player to score more than 1,000 points. The first black female mayor of a major American city. The first black woman to lead the treasury and energy departments. The first black woman to win a grand slam. And now the first black woman to become a major party's presidential candidate. Are all AKAs. The first black woman to fill in the blank is almost always a sorority woman. Dana Williams, an AKA and a dean at Howard, told me, it's incredibly hard to achieve the first without the sorority backing, because of the networking and bravado. At the DNC, I met Jolanda Jones, an AKA who is a Texas state representative, a former Survivor contestant, and a one-time star of Sisters-in-Law, a reality show about black female lawyers. She was holding court near a concession stand, hugging people and saving their numbers in her phone. When I asked her why she had joined AKA, she looked at me as if I had asked her whether to season meat before cooking it. Because it's the best, she said. I mean, is there even a question? She'd already booked her flight and hotel for the inauguration. I'm wearing pink and green. I'm having custom shit made. I ain't gonna be dressed like nobody else. Jones told me that she was at the convention to witness a black woman on the path to achieving what white women before her never had. Black women have been saving America forever, she said. There was no way I was going to miss this opportunity to be a part of history for a sorority sister. Alpha Kappa Alpha originated at Howard, the nation's premier historically black university, and was the first black Greek letter organization, BGLO, for women. Alpha Phi Alpha, the first BGLO for men, was founded 2 years before in 1906. Today, AKA has about 360,000 members, who belong to more than 1,000 chapters across the world. This summer, the nonprofit organization formed a PAC for the first time to allow political donations and later issued a challenge for members to raise $1,908,000 for Harris. When asked in late September if they'd met that goal, Danette Reed, the CEO and international president of AKA, told me, "We haven't given out any of those numbers at this particular time." AKA is part of the Divine Nine, an informal name for the council of the largest black fraternities and sororities. These organizations, which are all full of movers and shakers, have become a formidable block of support for the Harris-Walz campaign. As the former Atlanta mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, a member of Delta Sigma Theta, said, "This is a very powerful coalition, and it's a lane that the vice president uniquely owns. As I wandered around the convention, I spotted Christina Henderson, an AKA and a Washington, D.C. council member, near a step and repeat where reporters and TikTok influencers were trying to get a soundbite from Stacey Abrams, the former Georgia gubernatorial candidate. Henderson told me that on July 21st, she had been at Target buying school supplies when news broke that Joe Biden had withdrawn from the race and endorsed Harris. A girlfriend of mine FaceTimed me and she was like, 'Girl?' And I said, 'Girl?' And that was all. Henderson rushed home to attend a Zoom meeting organized by the group Win with Black Women, during which 44,000 people, among them politicians, church leaders, celebrities, and civilians, gathered to strategize about the campaign. Henderson had started attending the group's weekly meetings just before the 2020 election, when the Biden-Harris ticket won 90% of black female voters. Our organization has already had voter engagement, civic engagement efforts, so there's no need to build an infrastructure or anything different, Henderson said. Even before Biden left the race, the sorority had launched Take Four or More, a campaign to encourage each member to get at least four additional people to vote. The Divine Nine have a history of voter mobilization. Henderson called them the organized phone tree. Like many of the women I spoke to, she was both proud of and protective of Harris, steeling herself for the inevitable vitriol that would greet a black female candidate. Kendra Darling, another AKA and a first-time delegate from Florida, told me that the entire campaign felt personal. Her being a black woman and understanding that of course she was expected to face some challenges that we didn't see when Hillary ran, she said. She's been the first in many of these spaces. In the following weeks, Donald Trump was dismissive of Harris's sororial affiliations. He complained in September that Harris had missed Benjamin Netanyahu's congressional address for a sorority party. In fact, she had spoken at the biennial conference of Zeta Phi Beta, another historically black sorority. More than 6,000 people attended the conference in Indianapolis, and Harris was reportedly interrupted by applause 32 times in less than 20 minutes. Harris was born to an Indian mother and a Jamaican father. After her parents separated, she and her sister Maya were raised by their mother, a biomedical researcher. She knew her adopted homeland would see Maya and me as black girls, and she was determined to make sure we would grow into confident, proud black women, Harris writes in her memoir, The Truths We Hold. Yet, this racial pride has rarely found its way into Harris's campaign. In her convention speech, Harris instead emphasized her upbringing as a middle-class American. It has been her opponent who has been much more likely to discuss her race. Right before the DNC, Trump, in an interview at the annual convention of the National Association of Black Journalists, insinuated that Harris had changed her racial identification for political gain, saying that she happened to turn black. In her first major television interview as a candidate on CNN, Harris batted away a question about his comment. Same old tired playbook. Next question, please. Afterward, many of her supporters held up her time at Howard and her long and active affiliation with Alpha Kappa Alpha as proof that she'd always identified as black. Many people see in her AKA membership not just a signal of black identity, but a familiar kind of blackness. A down-home American-grown world of spades, stepping, homecoming parades, and cookouts. As the literary historian Deborah Elizabeth Whaley told me, Harris has a commitment to black cultural experience that the larger populace doesn't get. They don't know what it looks like. But her sorority sisters do. I love President Obama, and I love Michelle. But neither of them were Greek, Jolanda Jones said during our conversation. Michelle Obama was invited to become an honorary AKA in 2008, and she accepted on a non-exclusive basis. Black folks about to do more for Kamala than we did for President Obama. Among other edicts issued by AKA headquarters in recent weeks was one urging members to be cautious when speaking to the press. The day after Harris became the nominee, Soros received an email that read, "This message serves as a gentle reminder to be vigilant, careful, and mindful of how you are involved in the political process. Many AKAs in the DNC declined to say anything political beyond emphasizing the importance of voting or referred me to their press office. Similarly, AKA's customs and rituals are fiercely guarded by its members. When I called my auntie, who pledged AKA in 1994, to tell her that I was working on a story about her sorority, she told me how proud she was of me. But you know I can't tell you anything," she said. Harris, too, has upheld the secrecy surrounding the organization. She declined to be interviewed for this story, and she mentions the sorority only once in her memoir. I pledged a sorority, my beloved Alpha Kappa Alpha, founded by 9 women at Howard over a century ago. In a 2020 interview, she refused to do the sorority greeting known as Ski-wee for a black female journalist who was not an AKA. When you go through the process of becoming one, we can have that conversation, Harris said.
Ski-wee
is a high-pitched sound. Imagine Mariah Carey after sucking down some lemons. And a literal trademark of the sorority, registration number 5116853 in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. A few weeks after the DNC, 2 professors at Howard, Jennifer Thomas and Cheryl Johnson, who both attended the university at the same time as Harris, gave me a tour of the campus in Washington, D.C. Johnson is a member of Delta Sigma Theta. Thomas pledged AKA the year after Harris and thus felt compelled to refer to her famous soror as Most Gracious Lady Kamala Harris, as per sorority code. Before we began, Johnson pulled up an email on her phone and rattled off a disclaimer worthy of a commercial for a blood pressure medication. We're speaking in an individual capacity, not as Howard employees. Johnson wasn't speaking for Delta Sigma Theta, and I'm not speaking for Alpha Kappa Alpha, Thomas said. And Howard University is nonpartisan, thus no stance on the election. Then we set off for the science buildings. Harris matriculated at Howard in 1982. As a high schooler, she already knew that she wanted to be a lawyer, like her hero Thurgood Marshall, a Howard Law alumnus. Since then, she has essentially said that every positive character trait of hers that was not shaped by her mother was formed at Howard. In the 1980s, D.C. was peak chocolate city. Black people made up 60-70% of the population. It was also a golden era for historically black colleges and universities across the country. Children of the civil rights movement were entering higher education with strong racial pride and expectations of solidarity. In 1987, Bill Cosby created the Cosby Show spinoff, A Different World, which followed a Huxtable daughter at a fictional historically black college. It quickly became one of the top-rated shows on TV, and HBCU enrollment rates notably increased during its 6-year run. In 1988, Spike Lee released School Days, a film partly based on his experiences at Morehouse College, another HBCU. But Howard has long been referred to as the Mecca, a place where black achievement, community, and culture converge. The historian Natalie Hopkinson told me that attending Howard was tantamount to 4 years of living as a white man. Everything is in your image. Your history, your perspective, your lens on the world is all centered. Harris pledged AKA as a senior in 1986. About 300 women applied that year from a student body of roughly 10,000. 38 were accepted. Members of Black Greek letter organizations were particularly well regarded on campus. It was almost like being a celebrity, Lori Sattler, a line sister of Harris's and a vice president at Clark Atlanta University, told me. Sattler's mother was an AKA, as are 2 of her daughters. When her children were younger, Sattler dressed them in shirts that read, "My mom is an AKA" across the front, and "My grandmother is too" on the back. Thomas and Johnson still keep in touch with some of Harris's line sisters, and we compared notes as we walked by the president's house and through the Punch-Out, a campus cafe where Harris reportedly liked to hang out with the fraternity brothers of Kappa Alpha Psi. Sorority women who did so were called Kappa Sweethearts. Harris has written that the campus felt like heaven as soon as freshman orientation, and it was easy to see why. Black students of all complexions and nationalities and hairstyles milled around us. We stopped in the yard, the university's main quad, where 9 trees painted with Greek letters lined the perimeter. It was early in the semester, and students sat in candy red lawn chairs. Above them, a Pan-African flag and a pride flag fluttered amid the branches. On Fridays at noon, AKAs and other sorority members would congregate in the yard. The flagpole was the meeting point for protest. The trees were the party jump-off. Traditionally, BGLOs don't have their own housing. In recent years, a few of the organizations have installed commemorative statues on campus, but the trees, Thomas told me, were their unofficial national monuments. Alpha Kappa Alpha has a mission of service to all mankind, which must have appealed to the college-age Harris. One can almost hear echoes of her own 2020 presidential campaign slogan, Kamala Harris for the People. Historically, the organization also maintained a civic focus, with bylaws mandating that each chapter member perform at least one piece of Christian, social, or civic service in the community annually. Harris has spoken of Christine Simmons, a longtime family friend who was initiated into AKA in 1950, also at Howard, and later became president of an alumni chapter. In 1981, Simmons hosted Norma E. Boyd, one of the sorority's founders, who signed a copy of her memoir for Harris. That cherished book now sits in my West Wing office at the White House as a testimony to our enduring legacy, Harris told a crowd of AKAs at a convention in Dallas this summer. A legacy that began 116 years ago when Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated was founded to create desperately needed social and legal change and to build networks of support for black college women. By the early 1900s, only about 1,000 black people had graduated from American colleges and universities. Many, no doubt, had elders who could give them firsthand accounts of slavery. In 1896, Plessy v. Ferguson had codified Jim Crow laws. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People had yet to exist. Unsurprisingly, black students were banned from joining existing Greek letter organizations. In 1908, AKA's founding year, 89 black people were recorded as lynched. Alpha Kappa Alpha, like Alpha Phi Alpha before it, was forged as an act of self-reliance inspired by stories of sorority life on other college campuses. Ethel Heshman Lyle, a Howard senior from St. Louis, recruited classmates to create a group of their own in the spring of 1907. Using the Greek lettering system was a rejoinder to former Vice President John C. Calhoun's pronouncement that a Negro would never learn to parse a Greek verb or solve a problem in Euclid. From the beginning, AKA aimed to prepare its members for success. In disciplining women, Alpha Kappa Alpha, Black Counterpublics, and the cultural politics of black sororities, Whaley details some of the expectations that the organization set forth in the Ivy Primer, a sorority manual. The ideal soror should control excessive and public display of emotion, conceal weakness, multitask, never use excuses for failure to perform in life, be law-abiding, resourceful, tactful, exercise sound judgment, remain neatly dressed and poised, and be wide-ranging in conversational ability. In its first few decades, AKA advocated for anti-lynching legislation, full voting rights, and education for black children. During the Great Depression, it provided social services through programs such as the Mississippi Health Project, which brought mobile medical clinics to African Americans in rural parts of the state. In 1948, the BGLOs formed the American Council on Human Rights, which advised the U.S. government on civil rights legislation. In 1965, AKA was the first organization chosen to establish a federal job training program for women. In 1983, a.k.a. ran a letter-writing campaign to recognize Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday as a federal holiday. The sorority, along with several other civil rights organizations, sent 500,000 letters to Congress and collected more than 4 million petition signatures. Multiple efforts to pass the bill had stalled. But later that year, President Ronald Reagan signed the legislation into law after the bill was reintroduced by Representative Katie Hall of Indiana, also a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha. Greek organizations have a long history of using hazing rituals to weed out recruits. The process can range from forcing pledges to undergo mild humiliation to requiring more dangerous stunts. BGLOs also adopted this practice. In 1925, The Hilltop, Howard student newspaper, reported that prospective BGLO inductees went around campus singing songs and wearing old attire during their initiation. The next year, Thurgood Marshall, a member of Alpha Phi Alpha, was suspended from his HBCU for hazing recruits, which, as one biographer noted, he recounted with glee later in his life. One of his favorite pranks was to have pledges compete in a pantless race, with pickles clenched between their buttocks. In the 50s and 60s, hazing practices, which by then could include referring to pledges as worms, or forcing them to roll pencils across the floor with their noses, became inconsistent with the ideals of the civil rights movement. As hazing was outlawed by schools, many organizations moved their pledging activities underground, and incidents of violent or otherwise unsanctioned hazing activities increased. In 1989, an Alpha Phi Alpha pledge at Morehouse College died during a hazing session. The university temporarily banned the organization. As reports of these incidents continued to rise, AKA officially changed its process to focus more on knowledge of sorority history. But this didn't stop the problem. In 2002, two women drowned in California during an AKA pledging process. And in 2017, a woman who had recently been initiated into AKA at Northwestern University died by suicide after communicating to her big sisters that the hazing process was causing suicidal thoughts. In 2020, a lawsuit against the national organization related to the suicide was dismissed. For decades, pledges have submitted to the indignities of hazing because the practice was seen as legitimizing, even beneficial. A 2013 study in the Howard Law Journal called Belief, Truth, and Positive Organizational Deviance found that although too much hazing has negative outcomes, a moderate amount leads people to feel more positively about their organization and to become more active participants. There's a kind of human need when going into organizations to have some sort of ritualistic symbolism that allows the person who is outside of the group to go into the group and feel accepted. Lawrence Ross, a member of Alpha Phi Alpha and author of The Divine Nine, The History of African American Fraternities and Sororities, told me, "But it's a fallacy to believe that hazing creates loyalty." Chastity Mayo, a Christian life coach who was initiated in 2014 at Lamar University, officially renounced her AKA membership last year, in part because of the facade of friendship that she says she was expected to maintain. You're being forced to have relationships with people who are bringing you into the organization after they've mentally and emotionally abused you. And then you're expected to just be BFFs? Mayo said that her initiation felt like a cult experience. None of the 30-odd AKAs I interviewed would discuss hazing or provide details on or off the record about what Harris's process might have been like. She's been through it, Whaley hypothesized. They will be difficult on you. They will put you in circumstances in which you have to think quickly on your feet. This treatment, Whaley argued, may have helped Harris get through law school, become a district attorney, and run for Senate. On February 12, 1986, Harris and 37 other women received letters inviting them to the sorority's pledge ceremony. No one wanted to talk to me about the rituals involved. I finally found what seemed to be an AKA ritual manual from 1977 on WikiLeaks. It outlined instructions for an elaborate initiation ceremony, during which pledges dressed in black and wore wreaths of ivy. At least according to the manual, they prayed, sang, and took vows to be submissive and in every way to subjugate themselves to the highest authority, and to be free and clean of heart and strong to beat the glory to its goal. It looks like someone took aspects and produced an inaccurate document. I asked several AKAs individually if the document was authentic. In response, I received a group email from five of them declining to verify it and stating they no longer wish to participate in this story. Once inducted into AKA, Harris became known as C-Cubed, calm, cool, and collected. Much has been written about her time at Howard, her tendency to carry a briefcase around campus, and her participation in student protests against apartheid. Many of her line sisters told me that she was unflappable and precise, with a big, hearty laugh. During her freshman year, Harris was recruited for the debate team, the only place her affability didn't follow her. A classmate from that time has said, "The one thing I can always remember about Kamala is that she was always friendly and the nicest person. But in a debate, it was almost like a switch was turned." In her first year, her line volunteered at local hospitals and daycare centers, performed at a gospel show for seniors, and fasted to raise money for hunger. Before our tour concluded, Thomas and Johnson wanted to show me the campus chapel, which has stained glass windows that honor the Divine Nine. In the past century, Martin Luther King Jr., Desmond Tutu, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Mary McLeod Bethune have all spoken there. Every Sunday, Thomas and Johnson told me of their time at Howard. The members of the BGLOs would attend church together, dressed in black coats and padded leather shoes. Afterward, they'd line up like dominoes, Thomas said, and start their greetings. Some 40 years later, she still remembered how to greet older members. She straightened her back, stiffened her arms by her sides, and flared her hands, whipping her head back on every alpha. "Hello, most gracious ladies of the uppermost house of Alpha Chapter, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated, Howard University, Washington, D.C., 20059. Alpha Kappa Alpha was formed in part to cultivate friendship and community among like-minded black women in college. But nearly everyone I spoke with emphasized the feeling that joining was a lifetime commitment and that mentorship was key. For white folks, Greek life is a club," the sociologist Matthew Huey, an author of the Howard Law Journal article, told me. "For black folks, Greek life is a calling." After graduating, Harris too carried forward AKA's mission of uplifting other black women. Venus Johnson, the Chief Deputy Attorney General of California, worked for Harris more than a decade ago. When Harris was the state's attorney general, Johnson told me that a promotion by Harris, who counseled her on professional and personal matters, changed the trajectory of her career. In 2004, Latifah Simon, now a Bay Area congressional candidate, was hired in her early 20s by Harris, who at the time was the district attorney of San Francisco. Simon said that Harris has mentored her ever since. "When I see an unknown caller on my phone, I'm like, it's either student loans or Kamala Harris." Simon's tenure at the DA's office was part employment, part finishing school. She called Harris the toughest boss she's ever had and told me that she went to college only because Harris made her enroll. Once she did, Harris kept track of her grades. "And let me tell you, I was a grown-ass woman with a child," Simon said. She had also already won a MacArthur Fellowship. But no one had asked of me what Kamala had asked of me, and I found that I needed it and wanted it. But there is also, Simon insisted, a warmth to Harris. She's the type of boss who calls you on your birthday. When Harris's employees didn't have child care, she encouraged them to bring their kids to work, the way her mother had done with her and her sister. One day, Simon asked Harris a style-related question. Why did she wear pearls all the time? Harris told her that pearls were a reclamation of the way the world disparaged black women or saw them as rough. I went to Howard University, Harris told Simon. I'm a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha. If she wins, Harris would not be the first Greek to occupy the Oval Office. 19 former presidents were fraternity men. Several, including Rutherford B. Hayes, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush, were deeks, or members of Delta Kappa Epsilon, which was founded at Yale in 1844. These days, a quarter of the House and 64% of the Senate are members of a Greek letter organization. Professional success and fraternal affiliation have always had a chicken and egg relationship. Do Greek organizations produce leaders or just attract them? What comes first, the drive or the pledge? A career in politics no doubt appeals to members of fraternities and sororities, which in many ways are governments unto themselves. For everything in politics, there is a fraternal or sororal equivalent. Greek organizations have regular elections and distinct emblems. A national or international body, governed by alumni, set the rules. Parsing a bill on the Senate floor or fundraising for a campaign may come more easily to those who participated in similar activities in college. Kaya Lewis, who pledged AKA at Spelman College in 1992, is now the chief advisor for policy and strategy for the Office of Global Affairs at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She told me that she learned Robert's Rules of Order as an AKA, as well as two skills she still uses today, how to make a vegetable plate and how to run a meeting. Early fraternities expected their pledges, white, male, Christian, and preferably wealthy, to be among the most handsome, athletic, social, and confident members of their class, according to a 2010 study of the history of white college fraternities. Though emerging out of segregation, black Greek letter organizations, too, had supercilious standards for their members and rules about who could join. Sojourner Jackson, a former president of Zeta Phi Beta, once observed that when she was an undergraduate in the 1930s, fraternity and sorority membership demanded that recruits belong to a certain class. At that time, if you didn't have the money, if your parents didn't give it to you, you couldn't get into the organization, she said. Some recent undergraduate AKAs told me that their initiation fee was between $1,500 and $2,000, an eye-popping amount for which some inductees have to fundraise. Huey, the sociologist, described BGLOs as having a schizophrenic relationship with class. These organizations, make no mistake about it, are elitist, he said. Huey, who is white, is a member of Phi Beta Sigma, a BGLO. I grew up in a majority black neighborhood in the South, and a lot of my mentors were fraternity men, he said. Yet he pointed out that their social contributions cannot be ignored. He sees them as vibrant contributors to black life and to the betterment of white America, too. BGLO members were never expected to assimilate into white culture. Rather, it was hoped that they would anticipate and upend negative stereotypes by comporting themselves excellently, maintaining good grades, being active in their communities, advocating for equal rights, and so on. But the organization's image control could be oppressive to their pledges, and was in some ways reminiscent of the elitist exclusionary ways of white GLOs. I couldn't help broaching the concept of respectability in many of my conversations with scholars. The sense that these organizations were training their members this way for the approval of white people. Ross, the author of The Divine Nine, said that the battle wasn't for acceptance. It's about a fight for dignity in terms of the notion of fighting an ideology that says, you are, by being black, completely inferior. Even though BGLOs emerged from an effort to engender racial solidarity, they also have a history of reinforcing colorism. Until the 1920s, according to Whaley's book, 80% of the student population at 5 HBCUs reportedly was of a lighter complexion. Even when that began to change, the BGLO's preference for fair-skinned members was obvious. As one student wrote in The Hilltop in 1929, "We find these sororities and fraternities seeking the brotherhood or womanhood of those persons who are of light complexion or who are light brown-skinned. Very few are chosen from the third group or darker set. Alpha Kappa Alpha, in particular, has long had a reputation for colorism. In a 2011 study of stereotypes among members of historically black sororities, published in the Journal of Sorority and Fraternity Life Research and Practice, participants described AKAs as classy, rich, delicate, pretty, dainty, snobby, and light-skinned with long hair. Many sorors I spoke with over the phone told me their skin color, unprompted, as if to dispel AKA's reputation. Oh, I didn't know Kamala was an AKA, my sister said after I told her about this story. But I'm not surprised. She looks like one. I call all that urban legend, Danette Anthony Reed, the organization's CEO, said. AKA, right now, is all shades. Bria Baker, who was initiated into AKA's New Haven chapter as a Yale student in 2016, acknowledged that, as a fair-skinned black woman, she perpetuates the stereotype. Measures like ensuring that a soror's skin color is no darker than a paper bag may have fallen out of fashion, but more insidious forms of prejudice persist. Baker recounted that long flowing hair had long been integral to an AKA's presentation. Alpha Kappa Alpha has stepped up and done some really amazing things, sociopolitically, for the black community, she said. But if we only make space in those rooms for black people who look just like us, then that's not as liberatory as we might think. One way that AKA encourages a lifelong commitment is by increasing the likelihood that its members are accepted into the Lynx, an invitation-only service organization centered on prominent black women, and Jack and Jill, a cultural and social club for African-American children. Harris is an honorary member of the Lynx. These organizations all put a high value on professional success and view community service as both a form of outreach and a sign of conformity to a middle-class ideal. When Glenda Glover, a former president of AKA, told me that the Harris campaign and the organization shared a mission, I was not expecting her to talk about the effort to increase black female representation on corporate boards and in the C-suite. "We're putting people in positions of power so you can influence others," she said. She saw this mission in terms of destiny. "This is the ultimate, to become president of the United States," she said. "That shows how far God has brought us as a people, and how far black women have come." That was the article, Alpha Girls, Inside the Tight-Knit World of Kamala Harris's Sorority. It was written by Jasmine Hughes and published October 28, 2024, in The New Yorker magazine. I'm going to wrap up this week's African American Hour with a book review from The Guardian newspaper. The title is The Strangers by Echo Ishun Review, Five Black Pioneers. It was written by Colin Grant and published November 23, 2024. The subtitle to the story is From Malcolm X to Justin Fashanu. Ishun uses historical figures to illuminate contemporary struggles and his own alienation. All blacks in this country are condemned to be performers. This is the thought, allegedly, of Ira Ulrich, a 19th century black Shakespearean actor who features in Echo Ishun's The Strangers, Why allegedly? Because there's no record of Aldrich's assertion. Ishun's book, though, is not a novel. It's creative nonfiction. This innovative approach, while successful, will nonetheless vex historians who wince at the use of speculation rather than verifiable fact in presenting the past. Toni Morrison argued that black lives are spoken of and written about as objects of history, not subjects within it. How then to humanize and investigate the interior lives of historical figures in the absence of source material? It's a dilemma addressed in Ishun's hybrid of biography and memoir through an extraordinary feat of empathy. Along with Aldrich, Ishun takes four other black pioneers, Matthew Henson, an explorer, Frantz Fanon, a psychiatrist and thinker, Malcolm X, an activist, and Justin Fashanu, a footballer, and writes about them using the second person. But he does it so intimately that you becomes a proxy for I. In the chapter on Aldrich, his 1830s portrayal of Othello causes only revulsion in the mind of audiences who cannot accept a full-blooded Negro incarnating the profoundest creation of Shakespeare's art. But the actor is not enraged by detractors. His mournful response echoes his reflection on how it feels to play Othello in the light of Desdemona's betrayal. You feel only grief. The weight of this man's story bears down on you. The contrast between Aldrich's sensitivity and how he is misperceived by the white British public is pitiable. It's surprising to learn that for much of his life, Ishun, too, has felt misperceived. In decades past, as a cultural commentator, a favorite of the BBC's Late Review, editor of Arena Magazine and director of the Institute of Contemporary Arts, Ishun, capital E-S-H-U-N, seemed to transcend race. But lately he has addressed it more directly as curator of exhibitions such as in The Black Fantastic and The Time Is Always Now. He is alive to the way in which every black man is heir to a legacy of caricature, which renders him simultaneously invisible and hypervisible. Henson, for example, faithfully accompanies American explorer Robert Peary on a grueling Arctic expedition and subsequently claimed to be the first to reach the North Pole. But not only does Peary refuse to share the glory with his companion, critics such as Congressman Robert Macon use Henson to cast doubt on the venture, labeling him a useful Negro tool and an untrustworthy witness. The moral support of a white man, laments the English reporter Henry Lewis, would have done much more toward establishing an unqualified claim of success. Fanon, Malcolm X, and Fashanu are more widely known than Aldrich and Henson, but the same canopy of sadness and loneliness veils them, and Ishun captures it in his remarkable imaginative writing. In 1955, working in sympathy with Algerian rebels in the midst of a brutal colonial war with France, Martinique-born psychiatrist Fanon is stretched taut with the effort of maintaining a double life. A decade later, ostracized by the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X catches a sight of his mentee, Muhammad Ali, in Ghana. The pugilist turns his back. Watching Muhammad's car roar away, you know it's not possible for real love to disappear, even in the heat of betrayal. Fashanu, threatened with lurid tabloid expose, reluctantly comes out, becoming Britain's first openly gay footballer before his suicide in 1998. Stories from Ishun's own life provide the thread that links his case studies and includes glimpses of unease over his racial identity. In one stark moment, he confesses that at the age of 9, he took a Brillo pad to his face to rid him of his shameful blackness. There are vignettes of other trailblazers, such as the musician and producer Jay-Z. Ishun praises Jay-Z for his final disavowal of the shell of unfeeling masculinity that he has carried through life in favor of an open embrace of vulnerability, a reckoning with love as the signal marker of black humanness. It's a fitting description of the author, too. Ever since leaving home for university, dumping his past into a black bin liner bound for the incinerator, it seems Ishun has been a stranger to himself. His book is an act of rapprochement rendered with great emotional intelligence and tenderness. That was a review of The Strangers, Five Extraordinary Black Men and the Worlds That Made Them by Echo Ishun, published by Hamish Hamilton. The title of this review is The Strangers by Echo Ishun Review, Five Black Pioneers. From Malcolm X to Justin Fashanu, Ishun uses historical figures to illuminate contemporary struggles and his own alienation. This book review was written by Colin Grant and published November 23, 2024, in the Guardian newspapers, the Guardian.com website. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.